Hi, I'm Vicki Langford with Project 3810. We are a business incubator here in West OKC, and our mission is to help people become better bosses. Project Boss is our special op to accomplish our mission. Bosses have to manage the business from sales to operations to finances. Bosses need to develop their leadership styles and effectiveness in order to achieve results. And our boss members participate in peer coaching through boss board meetups and boss board roundtables. We expose our bosses to subject matter experts and introduce them to key players to help them achieve their business goals. Hi, everyone. Vicki here with the Boss Board. This episode, we are covering product development. And I have some great speakers with me today. I have Kyle Golding, who is on our advisory council, marketing.
Hey, glad to be here.
And he is representing the marketing aspect of this team. And then I have Michael Combs. He's representing our engineering team.
Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Michael. So give me 30 seconds. Tell me about yourself, Michael.
My name is Michael Combs. I'm the Director of Product Development at DD Audio. I've got a background in physics and computer science, and I've been writing software and developing electronic hardware for about 25 years now.
Awesome. Kyle?
Kyle Golding, CEO for the Golding Group. 36 years as an entrepreneur. Business development, marketing, process, and because of that touches on product development too. So I've done my fair share of some product development as well.
Awesome. All right, so we are going to go to our respective corners, and I, Vicki, am going to represent the accounting team, and we got Kyle representing the marketing team, and we've got Michael representing the engineering product development team.
It's a battle royale.
Wah-ha. Let's get started. All right. Accounting is first off going to say no. So marketing, why don't you start us off? Because, you know, marketing is maybe sometimes where some of the idea creation generates, or like there's some market feedback maybe that's driving.
Market feedback is exactly where some of the best ideas should come from. The market and the market factor should really drive the process of product development, of what do people appreciate about our product or service, what are they willing to pay for, what do they not appreciate, maybe.
And the trends, I think that's where market research plays a huge role. And sometimes people don't understand that the marketing team should be doing a little bit of market research. They should understand their industry.
We should be doing a lot of market research. Good. In fact, a good chunk of a good marketing plan is competitive analysis. It's who you're competing with directly and indirectly. So in the case of a product, you should know the product that you go head to head with. You know, if it's a microphone or a recorder or a car audio speaker or a cell phone or a can of beer, who's going to pull out a dollar and put their money behind one of those products. And then there's indirect, you know, is it a can of beer? Is it competing with a Coca-Cola or with a glass of iced tea or with, you know, things of that nature? So direct and indirect. But at the end of the day, when someone votes with their dollar for your product or not, there's a lesson to be learned there. And when enough things happen, you get trends, and that trends included in feedback should be part of the decision-making process to whether you're on the right track, you're missing something, or you need to be doing something different.
And I think you make a very clear distinction between that aspect of what a marketing department is doing versus just the creative team. So we won't get into that. That's another episode.
Creative is last.
So
creative should be last. Creative is just the outward expression of the work.
And they need the content. They need all this information.
The marketing department has to do the work before that
strategies
happens.
And that
marketing work should be collaboration with engineering, with sales, with accounting, with production, with everyone, you know, in the four walls, if you will, should be informing those decisions before creative ever gets involved. They just do what we tell them to.
All right.
I'm glad there's no creative people in the room.
I agree.
I'm a reformed creative myself. I got into marketing as a creative, and so I can say these things with
all the love in our heart for the creative team.
That's right. All you designers and creative directors can't get mad at me. I've been there for you, and I defend you when I can, but I also will throw you under the bus when it's deserved.
Okay, Michael. Kyle, tell us what you think of the engineering team. What do they do?
Engineers like to build cool shit.
Okay, let's leave it at that. Michael, your turn. what's your role in the beginning like of how a product should come to be based on what he just said?
Well, as much as we may not like it, we do need marketing people sometimes to tell us what to build. So that's an important part of the process. Otherwise, all our work is just wasted.
Oh, you're over there making cool shit. All right. So tell us a little bit more about what you feel as product development side, because that is the topic of this conversation, are some of the pitfalls to avoid.
Well, I find that most of the time products are not failing because of a lack of technological, necessarily innovation, or a lack of completion of technology. You know, as an engineer, I can write software, I can develop hardware. The hard part is deciding what to write and what to develop. And without clear goals, clear criteria for success, we're just wasting a lot of time and money.
Okay, so how do we fix that?
We need a feedback loop between marketing and product development. And I think that speaks to kind of the changes that we've seen probably over the last decade, where product development has become more holistic. You know, the concept of a product manager kind of overseeing marketing and supply chain and things like that. But there's still a lot of companies out there that haven't transitioned to this new way of doing things, and so there's a lot of problems.
And sometimes the missing components is cost or some other sort of factor behind just not having the right people in place or being assigned to it. Some people know they need that help in those areas and they just don't feel like they are capable of it. And then some people just ignore it because they either think it slows them down or complicates the process, or ultimately at the end of the day, they're afraid it's going to tell them not to do the thing they want to do.
Right, right. And that one of the missing components that I find in a lot of companies is the lack of studying the feasibility when they get started on a project. We get attached to our ideas or creative ideas. That's the fun part, you know, and we start moving forward and we forget to study the feasibility. And in fact, if you look at a lot of online materials regarding product development, they tend to leave that step out. And I like to perform a feasibility study during the concept development. You know, I'm going to look at...
Let's break that down a little bit. What is feasibility study?
Sure, really. It just comes down to, you know, is it feasible to build this product? Is it feasible to make money from this product?
How do I know? Of course it's feasible.
Well,
I want it.
the can it be built is one question. Can it be built with a profit margin is a completely different question.
All right, so how do you figure that out?
Well, generally the first thing I start with is just to look at market pricing. You know, if I'm going to build a product, whether it's a physical hardware component or a piece of software, what can I charge for it? What will customers pay for it? And from there, if it's a physical product, I can determine a cost of goods based on standard pricing margins. And then I've got a budget for my product.
Cool. How do you, let's say you have done a little bit of feasibility study and now you start into the next phase. What's after that? And is there iterations and stuff that happen along the way?
Well, I think, you know, once you've set a COGS estimate, a cost of goods sold estimate, set a budget for your product, you can start to estimate development costs, resources, personnel. If it's a physical product, then I'm going to start to estimate supply chain. You know, I'm going to talk with prospective vendors. I'm going to research shipping costs. Do I have minimum order quantities? Do I have tariffs? And from there, I can estimate an order plan and see what kind of cash flow it's going to take to develop this product.
And what about the customer along those weight lines? Where does the customer fit in?
Well, I'm probably going to calculate a customer ROI for that product as well, a return on investment, especially if it's an expensive product, if it's a business product rather than a consumer product. So
what does that mean? How do you do that?
Well, I'm going to look at the customer's business model and estimate how long it's going to take for them to get a return on investment for that product. And that's going to help me set the pricing. In fact, that's an integral part of estimating market pricing.
But I'm the customer. I want everything.
But actually, I think at the same time, something that's becoming more and more important right now in 2022 and definitely will more in the future is also calculating lifetime value.
Right.
It's something that's become more and more important for our clients as well. Obviously, you need to find recoup cost and ROI and all of that good stuff. But lifetime value is also a huge component in the conversation. Is this something that someone buys one time and lives with forever, or is it something that is intended to be utilized and thrown away or wear out or replaced every year or every season? Or is it like your iPhone where, you know, you're going to eventually upgrade it every couple of iterations because this, the new version is just that much better. But even the lifetime value of something like an iPhone, because if you got an iPhone 1, 2, 3, 4 or something and really became convinced that was the part of your lifestyle, when 13 comes out, you just automatically get up, you know, upgrade to it. Now you can put into your cell plan that every year you get the new version of the phone. So now you're not just talking about selling a phone this year, but you're talking about selling that phone to a consumer for their lifetime, sometimes even automatically. So that's part of the conversation as well. It's a longer look and a lot harder to kind of put a dollar figure on outside of based again on your brand position as a luxury item versus want, need, and things of that nature. But it's becoming more and more important in 2022, 23. I think that's why I wanted to bring that up quickly as part of that conversation. But at the end of the day, if you can't build it and make money on it in a relatively manageable amount of time, then what's the point?
Right, right. And I think a large number of projects, if they undertook a feasibility study to start with, they would probably never be started.
I would guess most products would never be built if they did that.
You've got some stories. Tell us some examples.
Well, I've been involved in a few projects that I've kind of stepped into leadership towards the end, and one particular project was for a drive-through kiosk, a touchscreen drive-through kiosk. And it was a fantastic product. The customer loved it. It increased order accuracy by close to 35%.
And that's big. 35% increase. That's a massive increase.
By nearly all accounts, it was a successful product, except for one. The enclosure was incredibly complicated and difficult to build. The vendor could only produce about 8 units per month.
Wow.
Right. And for the product to be successful, we determined that we needed to produce about 100 units per month just to be able to provide the support staff necessary to maintain the product. And so it was a difficult decision, but a simple feasibility study, a spreadsheet that took about 20-30 minutes to make, revealed the flaw. And unfortunately, the company had already spent $300,000 to $400,000 in development on this product.
Ouch. So let's pretend you were starting at the beginning of that project. So just to clarify the things that we've talked about, how would you have been able to avoid that? Or was it too late to find additional vendors, or was it already too complicated?
The enclosure design was complicated, so complicated that an additional vendor, it had to be hand-built. It's a product, though, that could have been saved by a feasibility study early on. If they had determined those COGS, if they had determined a budget for those cost of goods, it very likely would have led to the development of a much less expensive enclosure.
Pull some of that cool factor out.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. And build something less cool but more practical.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, the customer didn't really care about cool. They cared about return on investment.
And you find that a lot, especially on business to business.
Right.
Is like function is almost more important than form. Is that the right analogy?
A simple product that's sort of cool but profitable is much more impactful than the very cool product that is just not obtainable at all.
Right. And as a customer, I mean, tell me the last time you pulled up to a drive-through kiosk and considered how cool the interview
was. Wow.
I loved hanging
out. I'm coming
out
here every day to touch this.
Right.
But then I've heard you say a cool phrase that I love, and I think that should be on the walls of save it for version 2.
Right. Sometimes all these cool, great features, you know, feature creep, you know, the never-ending project, everybody's probably been involved in one of those. Everybody's disappointed that you want to get rid of features. But what I always tell them is save something for version two.
Yeah.
You want to sell something next year? Do you want to sell a second product?
And the difference between want and demand, and simply wanting a feature or wanting something built into a product that's not being demanded by the audience, and it goes back to the market should drive the decision-making process. So if it's not being demanded, if it's someone's not willing to pay for it, if it's not going to create additional sales, then what's the point?
Yeah. And that makes sense, too, of like save some wow for a couple of, you know, more iterations. So even though as the engineering team, you're like, yeah, we could do this and this and this, then let's give them just what we know they are excited about right now, and then add the extra wow on another
you
version.
Might find that your consumer getting like what you would call your base version, you know, with, oh, we'll upgrade this in version 2 and version 3. They may be so happy with version 2 or version 1 that they never asked for version 2. And you don't ever need to go down that path. Thus, the profitability becomes quicker in that process. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right. And it's easy to get carried away, to get excited about new features and adding on to a product. But I find that most of the time our great ideas are wrong. And until you get it out in the field and find out what people actually use, you know, it falls into the category of don't solve a problem that you don't have yet.
Yeah. So that's a great point, too, of like, how do you really determine, based on these ideas and concepts, what the features should be on that first generation?
Well, that just comes down to market feedback. That's where marketing comes in, and that's why they're so important, is we really need that information from them. As an engineer or a developer, we kind of have an innate understanding of the technology, and so we know which button to push, and we know how the device works. Whereas a user coming at it from a completely new perspective, they don't understand these things. And so as an engineer, we tend to be biased in making those decisions.
Yeah.
You start something simple, surveying even simpler than that, literally asking questions and making comments and polling on social media channels, et cetera. Then you can get into a little bit more formal surveying and asking questions of your consumers, especially if you have, you know, if you have point of sale data, if you have connections, you can send text and emails to people who you know have purchased or have opted in to your updates because they're a fan of your product or service, asking them, literally asking them what it is they're looking for, what they would find value in, having them do things like rank by priority. Now, still at the end of the day, they're giving an opinion, but they're putting skin in the game. They're not putting their hard-earned money down, but you're closer to the idea of the potential product than you are of just the three of us sitting around the room going, you know, it'd be cool. Like, that's the germination starting place, but that should not be where decision making happens. Outside information that's collected through your marketing channels of your primary consumer, not everybody, you know, everyone is not your customer, but the people who have bought your product or service in the past, who are influenced in that industry, maybe buying from your competitors, if they'll give you feedback, that then you again goes back to trends. If you can find trends in that feedback, and there's a logic to it as to how this would fit into the market, what space would enter, the pain it would alleviate, you know, the yeah. want or need. If all of those things start to add up, then you get some insights into what it could and should be, and that's where you start the ball rolling into an MVP and start doing some physical testing. That's where you get into small groups, you get into focus groups where literally in the room with the product, you know, put your hands on it or you know, type in this or do whatever.
Do you feel an engineer should be in that process, or is that somebody else's job?
No, definitely an engineer needs to be in that process. There are going to be aspects of that process that an engineer understands better than a marketing person, and vice versa. So
it's very collaborative process.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And so let's throw the CEO under the bus.
Cool. Yeah.
Come on, Michael.
You know, it's very important for the CEO. You know, one of their jobs is to drive innovation and to drive their workforce. You know, very often they have concepts or ideas that may be very challenging or difficult or unachievable. But the idea is to motivate people and to keep them moving forward. You can get into dangerous territory, though, when a CEO becomes too attached to an idea or notion and they're pushing a project forward despite contrary information from marketing or
sales
or testing.
Yeah.
The worst thing that can happen is no one in the building can say no to the top person. We keep saying CEO, but it's someone of authority at the top level.
Yeah.
It could be anyone in the C-suite, but someone who sort of can't be overridden. Sometimes even the owner. And it's even worse when it's the owner that's not on site all day, every day. When the owner is also the CEO that's also hands-on daily, there's some reality that is in that person's brain. But an owner who's living in another state, who just collects their monthly dividend checks and then calls up and goes, hey, it'd be cool if we did this, call me next month when it's done, and the C-suite gets the marching orders and everyone's going, if no one in that process,
that's a bad company,
that's terrible.
That's bad.
So there's gotta, so you have to have systems.
Don't do that.
You have to have systems in place. Whether it's your development process, your marketing process, your strategy, all of these things that allow you to, at any point when something doesn't make sense because it's off the mission statement, it's off the true north, it's not your actual wheelhouse of what you do, it's not in the position that you take in the industry, et cetera, to be able to say, no, I don't care what the CEO wants. That's not what makes sense to our business.
You could lean on accounting to help you.
Accounting's not bad at it.
Because accounting can really help you show numbers. And sometimes somebody in that top position really needs to see is the bottom line. And so, again, that collaboration with what are we doing, what are our costs, and what is – and again, not – the sales team is the closest connection to the customer, especially if you're an existing company and you already have sales, then – and we want to iterate or we want to innovate – that's like they have like knowledge. Now we can't just take, because I think we said that already, but customers will want everything, it's like, right. Hey, should we make this product? Yes, you should. Because we can't just take the surface level answers. We need to really understand and listen to just their normal things and see what they're already buying and see what other products they're buying and listen to their whines, because in the whine is probably
pain point.
Yeah, a salute, like an innovation or a product that's just waiting.
If you go through the process of paying attention to all of these indicators with the idea of listening to the actual data, you'll get to the right decision. If you go through the process to sort of answer a question the way you want it to be answered, you can find that too. I can find any answer you want in any string of data. I can tell you any trend that goes this way if I really want you to lead that way. But having a process that ends on the best decision and not always saying yes or always saying no or always hitting a specific price point, it's going to be in a ballpark area, is enough to award you away from bad decisions and push you towards better decisions. So at the end of the day, it's decision-making process. That's why product development isn't a singular activity. It isn't a one day. It isn't get in the room and build it. Even the MVP itself. And there's so many levels of process, because at each level of process allows you to either move forward in a better way or stop. And if you get focused on always moving forward and always attempting to sort of force a better way, you put yourself in a bad situation. Allowing the process to stop you when it's necessary is how it's supposed to work.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's a revolutionary concept, right? looking at the data and the facts and making objective
That's
decisions.
That's crazy. Why would I do that?
And if you can't afford to do it, don't do it. Amazing. Right.
Well, and I want to speak from, because, DD has been around for 35 years. The way we're working right now today, we have to like literally do things different, because we need to do it at a scale that those times where we launch a product that we didn't get right are way more expensive, and we can't afford that. Where in the beginning we could iterate a little bit differently, a lot of our customers were the early adopter customers, and they would give us immediate feedback, and it was you know, it was one person on the phone, one person in the engineer shop, one person talking to the suppliers. So that's a different thing than as you grow and scale to do what you're talking about with the processes and really get that collaborative team, because you can't do it alone, but you have to be able to have the good communication of all the departments to get it right.
Right. Yeah, the sooner you start developing process, you can always scale those processes. So the sooner you start implementing these things and making decisions based on data and not decisions based on want and ego and cool factors.
Or intuition, because I'm guilty, done it well, lots of times.
We have to be open to new ways to succeed. The ways we've succeeded in the past are not always the ways we're going to succeed in the future. And so you just have to be able to adapt to that.
And the last 2 years is definitely another perfect storm of being able to adapt. But also, like, in the case of DD Audio, in the mobile electronics space, cars are totally different than they were 10 years ago.
But also the concept of car ownership has changed.
Yes.
And that will continue on. You see all the major manufacturers going, you know, towards electric and self-driving and things of that nature. Transportation is in a flux right now. And that secondarily affects your market and your industry.
Yeah.
So sometimes...
But it's been going on for years, like changing head units, right, to computer and just the technology that's in a car now. Even though the car industry in general has lagged behind normal technologies like our phones and stuff, but now it's kind of catching up. And it's really...
It's an avalanche of catch-up.
But that's right just... Now. I'm trying to speak to the concept of following not only your specific trends of the data, your industry,
right,
and kind of seeing what's happening there. And that's, to me, that department of market development, product development is long-term strategy. They need a certain amount of autonomy to understand and research and dive in and listen. They need to not be involved so much into the normal churn, like, because you've got some core products out there, you should be selling those and having a balance between new products that come in, let the current products live until demand actually dictates that they should go away, introduce new things.
If it happens at all.
And introduce new things, but then let the market decide if that should replace an existing product. That's one of the hard lessons we're experiencing these last couple of years right now as we try to scale. So just wanted to add that in there. All right, we're going to wrap up. We've taken about 30 minutes. This is a huge topic. I hope you are getting something out of it. But let's, some closing thoughts. Go ahead, Kyle.
The market is the market. The market decides, the market drives. You just have to pay attention to it and make your decisions based on that and not based on your own personal preferences and ego. The worst client in the world for me is the one who's like, but here's how I want it. The second worst client for me is the one who says, here's how my wife wants it. And it's no insult to anyone's spouse, but that's fine if your spouse is the target audience. It doesn't matter the person who owns a company, the person that they have dinner with every night, their kids. None of that matters unless they're the target audience.
Unless they have cash in their wallet.
And they're willing to put their money down and appreciate and value your innovation to a point that they're willing to make a transaction and create that transaction. But then again, back to the idea of overall life, the value of lifetime. So it's a small picture, it's a big picture all at the same time, but it's all about building and meeting expectations of your consumer. And if you can do that, you can give them what they want because you asked them, because you paid attention, then the potential for your products to succeed goes way up.
All right, Michael.
I would say just start collecting data day one. The second you get an idea, start collecting data. Update it as frequently as you can. Make objective decisions. Share those decisions with your team and bring them along with you, and you'll be successful.
Awesome. You guys have been a great
power.
Panel.
Data is power. Data is power.
Awesome. I appreciate you guys so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thanks, Vicky.